Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 85 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 944. Okay. We worked our way through that block of three papers on marriage and family. Remember, we ended with them punctuating our recognition of the foundational aspect of marriage and family to civilization. And all of the institutions, all the stability, all of the dynamism of civilization, it's all predicated on that foundation, and when that's in jeopardy, all of civilization's in jeopardy. Now we're going to shift gears. We have a new block of papers, longer block of papers here, on the evolution of religion. And, we remember how we went through that block of papers on civilization and covered an awful lot about the evolution of civilization in that process. This is another element of the whole evolutionary process. So we're dropping all the way back again, and this time focusing on what humans have been up to beyond sort of the immediacies, often very pragmatic immediacies of the evolution of civilization, in a straightforward sense. Obviously, the evolution of religion is part of the evolution of civilization. But for a very, very long time, and still mostly today, it's a curious parallel aspect. Easy to understand, because after all, if there's any genuineness to what you're calling religion, it is predicated on the inner life. Yeah, and the basic pragmatics of the evolution of civilization is about the outer life. So, it can't help but be, at least initially, kind of a parallel phenomenon. But, as you recall, when we're talking about just the evolution of civilization in general, you have a lot of the energy for the basic concepts that people have in terms of the mores system and what kind of institutions they have and whatnot. I mean, the basic energy for the generation of that is coming from this internal phenomenon. As we'll see as we start to read, it doesn't start out in any genuine way as the inner life. So if you speak of it as about the inner life, you got to kind of put inner life in quotes. But it's at least more internal in its foundational dynamics than things like, how do we interact with that other tribe, and what do we do to get food, and those sorts of things, that very much have their origins in the outer life.
But without the adjective, it wouldn't happen at all.
Yeah, and as we'll see almost immediately when we read, what you're fundamentally, bringing into play, or maybe I should say that you're focusing on more exclusively, is the remember how we talked about civilization? We talked about, okay, just society, and that's really predicated on the fifth adjunct. When you have something that's more called of a culture, you're bringing in some of the energy of the sixth adjunct. And then the fullness of civilization brings in the seventh adjunct and the encirclement and the Holy Spirit. Well, you know, here we're going to focus on that that energy that we just kind of said in general was producing a culture, you know, in distinction to merely a society now. Okay, so like I said, yeah, it's obviously related to what we were talking about before, but we want to think, not so much about, you know, how that gets socialized, but just more this basic originating phenomenon that humans have always had. You know, where it comes from, how initially it appears to us, and what happens to give it some greater substance and genuineness as a conscious phenomenon. But you can tell by the title of the paper, you know, it has the word origins in it. We are very much going to start out when, like we did with civilization, where you don't have a lot of very conscious, genuine, spiritualized mind, personalized self sort of a phenomenon. It's all very natural, and everyone is just, you know, going along kind of, you know, from what we would say mindlessly, you know, in regard to these issues. You know, they're just being driven by the natural energies within us. And obviously, we want to always be thinking about how we're not just studying the religion of primitive people. You know, always when you're doing that, you're also studying the current primitive religion of, you know, of the present people. And why, you know, why is that so much? Why is there still so many things after a million years that are very much like what they were a million years ago when you literally had primitive people? Which, you know, I mean, even if genetically you still kind of have some quote-unquote primitive people today, they're not primitive like they used to be because it's post-Pentecost, if nothing else. I mean, there's a whole different dynamics. Plus, you know, everyone has a little bit of racial blending and stuff, and, you know, it's not like it was literally for those first few hundred thousand years, starting a million years ago. Okay, but nonetheless, some of those things that were dreamt up way back then are still in play today, almost without any change. You know, why is this area of the evolutionary process so resistant to the evolutionary process? You know, in any sort of overt way that other things seem to be open to change. Okay, so I'm just kind of tossing out of all these sorts of things. You know, we'll engage in context at various places as we go through this. Let's not speak abstractly anymore. Let's actually get something to grab a hold of here, and let's read this first paragraph. What do they have to tell us here?
Paper 85: The Origins of Worship. Primitive religion had a biologic origin, a natural evolutionary development. Aside from moral associations and apart from all spiritual influences, the higher animals have fears but no illusions, hence no religion. Man creates his primitive religions out of his fears and by means of his illusions.
Okay, so very simple, short little paragraph to get us started. So let's get ourselves in the proper frame. What are these initial things that they're tossing out? Okay, it had a biologic origin. They say natural evolutionary development. Okay, well, the first thing we can bring in, because this isn't the first time we've talked about these sorts of issues. Wait a minute. It's like religion is fundamentally when humans are doing that which is unnatural. So how can they say that primitive religion was a natural evolutionary development? Oh, well, okay, we kind of have religion in quotes here, don't we? But we have they're using the word religion because by grace, super consciously, there is genuine religion. Way, way, way super consciously, even in the, you know, these very primitive people. And that fact that's up there, you know, basically on the sixth level of meaning, you know, when you've got people that are barely getting up to the second level of meaning, okay? But nonetheless, that fact that's up there on the sixth level of meaning by grace, a genuine religious consciousness, casts a shadow deep down the levels of meaning, all the way down to the, you know, the foundations of the mind, right down onto the zeroth level, the level of fear. Right? It's a penetrating fact way up there. And so, you know, it casts a shadow down. There's no direct consciousness of genuine religion, but there is going to be a consciousness of a curious desire to approach things in certain ways, way down even on the level of the flesh. Okay, and before we get to that specifically, notice what they also say there in that opening sentence. Not only is it biologic and natural, but it's aside from moral association and apart from all spiritual influence. So initially, when you're talking about religion, quote unquote, it's not what everyone kind of immediately thinks of today. Oh, there's some moralism that these people have dreamt up. Okay, that's obviously a subsequent phenomenon, that religion gets all moralistic. Okay, and then there's just the direct statement of what I was alluding to, and apart from all spiritual influences. Okay, you know, and they don't mean, you know, sort of the very, very downstepped unity influences way down in the lower levels of meaning, you know, here. By spiritual, they mean, you know, full on those, you know, in any direct fashion, those spiritual influences that engage the upper domain of the mind. Right? This is all very much down in the lower domain of the mind, very much apart from any sort of immediacy in relationship to the upper domain, and any sort of directness of being influenced by spiritual ministry, you know, from the cosmos.
Not the adjutant ministry.
Right, obviously not the adjutant ministry, that's all down at the bottom. But, to that point, are we going to be starting out really with the adjutants as the spirit of something, if it's apart from all spiritual influence? No, obviously. We're starting when, you know, you basically are just a fancy animal. There's fancier energies of mind. But initially challenge yourself to not think of it as the spirit of anything, like the spirit of worship, the sixth adjutant. It's going to be the energy of zeal and some other modes of it as an energy that we'll talk about here shortly. Okay, so now all that's probably very comfortable when we're talking about people way, way back, but it's okay. Remind yourself that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, right? Your development as an individual, you know, goes basically through the steps of the evolutionary process went through for the group, you know, over the millennia, you know, if not longer. Okay, so you start out the same way. Okay, that first sentence, you know, is talking about your initial primitive religion as a child of God. That's how you start. Doesn't matter if it's post-Pentecost and everyone has an adjuster and all that stuff. It's still, you start apart from all such things with just adjutant energies giving you certain inclinations of behavior, of functioning of your mind. Okay, and you've got to work your way up through all the levels that the collective worked through over all that those long spans of time. You've got to go through all of that. And if you... You only have a few decades to live. You've got all kinds of assistance from the civilization around you and whatnot, but don't have any illusions, thinking, well, no, I was born way different. I'm immediately in full contact with spiritual influences. All the things that I think are spiritual are definitely spiritual. There's nothing delusional about my thinking. It's like, no. Okay, if that was the case, then okay, let's just skip this block of papers because who cares? Okay, what's the point of even reading it if it isn't relative to me? So you got that. Then they throw in this one little element: the higher animals have fears but no illusions, hence no religion. Okay, so what's in play? That's that shadow phenomenon that I was talking about. The thing that gets a lot of the notions of religion started is a vague sense that you have, even as an immature being, that there's some kind of mystery, there's some kind of divine secret. Okay. That belief that there is a divine secret that you can seek out, okay, that's what drives the development of all that comes to be known as evolutionary religion, as they're pointing out here with the illusions. Right? You have all kinds of experiences with material phenomena and the other material beings around you. But you're going to have this tendency, that, like they said, that an animal doesn't have, a pure animal doesn't have, to not just take them, those material doings, at face value. Because you know there's a divine secret. So you're going to take what you bring in from these material experiences on face value, you're gonna bring those in, and you're gonna say, yes, but I think there's more to it than meets the eye. I believe there's something there that can't be seen. Right? You're going to have illusions about it. The literalness of that word means you're going to play on what you have at face value. The root there is play. Okay, you're going to tell a little story, right? Starting on with what you get immediately, directly, as that being the stage for this play you're going to imagine, and that's how it gets started. You don't believe that you're just literally playing, because you know there's a divine secret, right? It's got to be somewhere. And so you look for some fancy experience or some fancy object, I think it's behind that. Right? It's unseen with that. That's where the divine secret is. See, now, when all is said and done, especially post-Pentecost, when everyone has one, right, that thought adjuster, one of the names for it is a mystery monitor, right? Why do they call it a mystery monitor? Well, because it's the divine secret that warns. Right? The mystery part means divine. You know, there literally is, post-Pentecost, in everyone, normal human's mind, a genuine, full-on fragment of infinity divine secret. So even more so now than way back when, you're going to start looking for a divine secret, you know. And it leads you to many things. Like it leads you to not take stories at face value. You interpret them as an allegory, where everything in it has a secret to it. Well, that really means, see, it's all this, it's that whole illusion thing. That's the basic energy behind generating what everyone calls religion, which isn't really religion, you know, in any sort of substantive way. It's the game we play with the shadows that are cast from way up above in our minds. Yep.
No mention is made of it here, but as I was listening to you speak, seeking for purpose, or trying to find out what the secret is, or divine secret, that made me think of purpose. Well, doesn't that come from personality? The notion that that there's a purpose to things?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if
right.
Animal doesn't consider what the purpose of anything.
Yeah, right. Like I said, you have all of these initial vague notions tied to these objective facts that you have way up in your mind by grace, superconsciously, right? And you don't really know of purpose directly, but you start using the word, and so you try to apply it to something. You know, that's personality, that's purpose, that's spirit, you know, that's divine, that's sacred, you know, that's truth, that's, you know, all these things, that's real, etc. You have these thoughts, but you don't really know what you're talking about. That doesn't stop you. You just start applying them anyway, you know, and off you go. Okay, yeah, John?
Back in when I was a PBS junkie, they had this psychology show, and they showed this, you know, it was probably back in the 90s, they probably wouldn't do it now, but they showed this chimp and this baby, or this real kid, and they said the kid and the chimp they'd be on the same level until about 5 years old, and then the kid just took off.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking the thought adjuster.
Well, no, it's not the thought adjuster. It's the encirclement in the Holy Spirit.
Oh. Okay.
See, again, most everything that you can think of that you strikes you as profound about ourselves, you know, is unfortunately, I think that's the spirit of truth, or I think that's, you know, the thought adjuster. No. That's, especially the thought adjuster, that's the last thing you would assume. I mean, the really, really immediate rubber meets the road profound thing about your mind is that your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. That's, and that gift of personality that can come then, because what that gives you is the ability, like they're saying, for instance, to have an imagination and illusions like this. You know, where you get above the immediate directness of a sensation that comes in, you know, and you imagine upon it, you know, well, you can't imagine up on anything unless you can get above the thing, right? See, and that giving you that spiritualized mind domain, see, even if you aren't consciously using what's there, you're not looking at what's up there in the upper domain, you're standing there. You're looking at what's down in the lower domain. You're all fixated on the, you know, doings in the lower domain. And you don't even think about it. It's like, wait a minute. If I can see what's going on in the lower domain, where am I standing? You know, the observer is not the thing observed. If I'm observing myself, where am I standing? Where am I standing? Capital I. Where does the capital I pronoun come from? Right? The best minds that have ever lived have missed that point. Right? You know, and until that sinks in, wait a minute, I'm standing somewhere above what I think is the totality of my mind. See, until you get that initial thought, okay, is it any surprise that you haven't really started doing anything directly at eye level with what's up there? No, you haven't even, you know, you think you're down below. It's like, no, that's illogical. You can't literally be standing down below, or you wouldn't be aware of what's down below. Right? You know, you can't be both the observer and the observed down there. The observer has to be apart, above. So that's the first step. You know, it's just, you know, for that to sink in solidly. And you go, well, you suppose there's something besides a place to stand up there? Maybe I should actually take a look up there and not be so fixated on myself down below. You know, and the, you know, and how so-and-so, you know, touched me and so-and-so bothered me and, you know, whatnot, you know, all that stuff. You know, it's like, you think that's what God gave you that place to stand for, is so you could just endlessly fixate on your animal origin creature and, you know, how it's slighted by this, that, and the other thing and whatnot, and has all these opinions randomly generated and all this sort of stuff? Is that what your spiritualized mind is for? A place to fixate on that, you know, stuff that's, you know, of utterly no reality when all is said and done? Has no relationship to eternity? Yeah, anyway, but to start with, okay, there's no recognition of any of this sort of, you know, objectivity, and you just have everyone focused on what's down below and playing upon it, looking for the divine secret down there. So all these, everything, you know, becomes not what it is at face value. Everything gets imagined into something really fancy that can't be seen. And it all starts with that foundation, like they said. Man creates, see, notice they said creates. See, so the personalized self is involved here, just not in any sort of eye level sort of a way, right? But he creates his primitive religion out of his fears and by means of his illusions. Right? That's the basic energy down there. It's the basic forms down there. So the illusions are going to be behind all those fears. Right? That's how it gets started. It gets started at the foundation, the zeroth level of meaning, and everything builds up from there. Before we go any further, I know we're kind of a lot about just the beginning here, but one of the things that we're going to be struggling with, that's right there in the title of this paper, is the word worship. Okay. We're basically not going to be talking about genuine worship. But we'll be talking about what everyone currently believes is worship. We're already talking about it right now, in the first paragraph. Right? Remember that challenge, that the fifth epical revelation is trying to say there's something on the sixth level of meaning that you're just not familiar with at all that is genuine worship. Okay, but there's all kinds of things that happen down below with the shadows, you know, that you could call worship, quote unquote, because they're sort of a play off of the genuine fact. In the same way that you could use the word love on the level of the flesh, or the word love on the level of the feelings, right, for affection, you know, or what have you. You know, you can think of it being downstepped, you know, or a shadow cast down. But you know, basically what you're actually talking about when they say worship is either reverence, which is a feeling in your mind, a mode of your mind that is put there by the sixth adjutant. The sixth adjutant generates this feeling in your mind called reverence. And the literalness of revere, the vir part, is the word fear. Right? So the re, you know, again, or, you know, it's reprocessed fear. It's fear anew. It's the culmination, like they're saying here. You start with fear, just raw, direct fear, and you lift it up from the zeroth level of meaning to the fullness of its unityization on the second level of meaning with the sixth adjutant as reverence. Fear anew, right? It's all bottom up. That doesn't mean that there isn't potential for a top-down reverence, but that's another story, right? The initial story is the bottom-up reverence.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, right.
There's right. A high level of reverence. I read about it kind of recently in Dementia.
Sure.
It's a beautiful thing.
Right, there's a very... But, see, again, we're not starting there. We're starting just the bottom-up, where the literalness of the word is important to remind yourself. You know, when you think about it top-down, you're not, you know, it isn't really that reprocessed fear anymore. But you're going to use the same word. You just have to understand it's, you know, being used in a transcendent way now.
And they do use the word.
Right, and they do. Okay, because, again, they're not going to just generate arbitrary words unnecessarily. They're going to challenge you to, you know, behold, this word is becoming new if you approach it from the top-down. Okay, but right now... You know, when we're talking about the origins of worship, there's no top-down. Like they said, it's apart from all spiritual influences. Zero top-down. Zero. Okay? It's all bottom-up, as they're telling you to begin with. And that's the way we all begin, too. Okay, and so that's sort of the... Reverence is the most immediate mode of the shadow that's cast down from genuine worship above. Is that functioning of the sixth adjutant, its reverence? But you can also, you know, you might more literally mean, instead of worship, even though they might say worship, they might mean veneration. Okay? Veneration and reverence are kind of the two that, you know, are sort of, you know, the quote-unquote worship means. And by veneration, see, that's literally like Venus, right? The goddess of love. See, so that's another, you know, I just mentioned that shadow casting thing, right? The love that's on the sixth level of meaning, right, that's cast down. If that's kind of more the immediacy in play than worship, you know, being cast, you know, being a shadow cast down, then maybe what you're really kind of talking about is veneration and not reverence down there on the second level of meaning. Now, the other kind of technical thing, once you finally have a God notion in the evolutionary religion, then you start to think about the idea of talking to that God. Okay? And you might call that worship, too. But see, that's technically not worship either, even in its highest mode, even when you have genuine worship. That's adoration. Orating to, adoration, speaking to, right? You know, in the genuine sense, you get up to the sixth level of meaning, you synchronize with deity, a state of your mind called worship, and then through that synchronization, you can potentially speak to the universal Father. The adoration is carried through that worship. And when you're talking about worship in a fancier sense in various parts of the book, you've got to figure out. Because sometimes when they say worship, they mean both just merely worship and adoration also. Other times they mean just the worship part, not the adoration. You know, and maybe they'll actually say both adoration and worship to, you know, make sure that's clear to you. Okay. But initially here, we're not... You're not talking so much about adoration because you don't have much, you know, you don't have initially some sort of a God concept. So it's veneration or reverence is what you mean by worship. And maybe if the revelators don't say veneration or reverence and they say worship, they might not be just using worship as a quote-unquote, you know, substitute for those two words. They might be indicating that there's some definitive ritual involved in the people. You know, and so think about that. I mean, a lot of people, that's, if you say worship, that's what they think you're talking about. Oh, those rituals, those sacred rituals that people do in a church. They think that, you know, for a lot of people, all the word worship means is just a sacred ritual, a so-called sacred ritual. You know, and it doesn't really mean reverence or veneration even, right? But just the fancy ritual, okay? And so sometimes when you're seeing, you know, when you see them say worship here, think, oh, they're probably indicating that there's a, you know, some sort of ritual that the people had, okay? And that's why they didn't just say reverence or veneration. Because it's really complicated. You kind of have to kind of know what's going on before you get into this. And I'll occasionally point those things out when it's kind of significant to the issue at hand. All right, let's get some more here.
In the evolution of the human species, worship in its primitive manifestations appears long before the mind of man is capable of formulating the more complex concepts of life now and in the hereafter, which deserve to be called religion. Early religion was wholly intellectual in nature and was entirely predicated on associational circumstances. The objects of worship were altogether suggestive. They consisted of the things of nature which were close at hand or which loomed large in the commonplace experience of the simple-minded primitive Eurasians.
Okay, so you've got all these associational circumstances, And because of this tendency we have, all those things are not just taken at face value. Like I said, they're suggestive. Ooh, that's suggestive. And the play begins, right? The illusion begins. And you play upon that, you know, that basic circumstance, right? And dream up a whole divine secret story associated with it. Like I said, that's how it gets started, you know, and it's going to start, you know, the most basic material, natural experiences, you know, in the, you know, literally in the external world. It's not going to start purely in the imagination, see, that's important. I mean, for, you know, way down the road, what's called religion in some cases, you know, it's just purely generated, you know, in the imaginative domain. It's kind of totally predicated on figments. But it doesn't start out that way. Because, like they're pointing out, humans aren't that fancy to begin with. Right? Where they can totally start out and just, you know, with a pure fiction. And be satisfied with it. It starts out with objective facts in the external world. Yeah, that produce sensations in the mind, and then you add the illusion to them. Okay, you know, that, like I said, you know, you don't start out with those more complex concepts of what? See, of, in other words, anything that's some notion that's there because you have some conscious sense that you're tied to eternity. No, nothing like that to begin with. It's all purely temporal.
I was just going to guess that. See? I thought of that earlier. It's not connecting to eternity.
Right.
The seventh adjutant for that.
The seventh and the Holy Spirit and all that, right, to get to eternity. See, so you don't really start out with any sort of a shadow of eternity cast down. It's all very just temporal. And of course, that's always been the tendency. I mean, even today, it's almost impossible for any religionist to think about anything except material issues of time. I mean, Jesus pulled his hair out trying to get even his apostles, you know, to predicate their thoughts on eternity and spirit. It's like, no, everything was matter and time. Because that's the way it's always been. Because you can see it. And it doesn't matter that it's illogical. It's like, wait a minute, you're questing something you know you can't see, the divine secret? So why, you know, at some point, doesn't it occur to you that maybe you should just set aside all the things you can see in your quest for this? No.
How long must I bear with you?
You know?
I'm modern man who rejects religion, he might consider himself spiritual, but religion is balderdash. By definition, he would have primitive religion, fear, his fears and his illusions.
And of course, the so-called modern person that rejects religion, I mean, what he's rejecting is validly rejected. He's rejecting illusion, right? Like they're telling you. I mean, he's looking at this like, this is all just illusion. There's no substance here. I reject that. That's step one. You know, if you want to be a genuine religionist, you need to do what that person does, only don't be skeptical about it, right? Where, you know, it's just this a priori dismissal, and that's period, end of story, right? Don't do that in an ending fashion. Do that in a beginning fashion. Step one, get rid of all the illusion stuff, which means you're going to get rid of everything, right? I mean, the first paragraph of the book in the foreword says you've got issues with your ideas about God. Why? Because all your ideas are illusions. They're not based on reality. It's like, they're not illusions, because everyone deems them as transcendently sacred. Because we believe they're sacred, they're not illusions. No, it doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter how sacred you believe the illusions are. They're still illusions. And, and you need to find the real God. You need to download the real God. Stop uploading, right, the God notion from your environment, you know, that is an illusion. Yeah. That's the whole point. You have to cease to be satisfied with the illusion of God.
Uploading from the bottom up.
Yeah, right. And just see, know that, you know, you're not going to find the real God even by uploading the words in this book. Okay, right. All the book is going to do when you're in that mode is, it will make you all the more certain that your illusion of God is the real God. You'll never be fundamentally dissatisfied with the old wineskins that God is in. You need to liberate him from that old illusion-based framework. Okay, let's see. What else do we have here? Simple-minded, primitive Urantians. And they didn't say they lived a long time ago. Okay, what do they say next?
When religion once evolved beyond nature worship, it acquired roots of spirit origin, but was nevertheless always conditioned by the social environment. As nature worship developed, man's concept envisioned a division of labor in the supermortal world. There were nature spirits for lakes, trees, waterfalls, rain, and hundreds of other ordinary terrestrial phenomena.
Okay. So, you know, just for a moment there, we were thinking ahead and then we dropped back again. Once it evolved beyond nature worship, but, you know, meanwhile, back to nature worship. But just note, you know, they threw that in, okay, because they wanted you to think about how once you stop being so identified in your quote-unquote religious mode with those objects out there in the external world, something more genuine started to happen, they said. Okay, well, why? Well, because until you get to the genuinely spiritual, the unity substance, right? You can't get the genuine religion. You know, spirit is a separate substance from matter. You know, spirit is unity made substance. Matter is individuality made substance. Okay? And they go on to say, see, I mean, because you're not there, and you're basically playing with material objects and stuff in your mind, there's always going to be a boat anchor dragging you into individuality, All right, so you won't stay in some, you know, sort of very fuzzy animistic unity notion about the material world. It'll get lumpy, okay? It will start to individuate, you know, and you won't just have an overall spirit. You'll have a spirit for a lake and a spirit for a tree and a spirit for a water. See, it gets individuated. Okay, and that's a material gravity is dragging you down to individuate so that it isn't just this ubiquitous reverence. It gets, like I said, chunky. Okay. So,
but as the people evolve, it does get more, a little bit more diffuse.
Yes, yes. You know, and but you notice the little thing that
even to concept of a nation or a people,
yeah,
or race.
Right, but
you know, before it goes to an infinite, eternal God. You know.
Yeah, but notice the little thing they threw in there. But see, but was nevertheless always conditioned by the social environment. So even when you start to get a little bit more genuinely predicated on the spirit influence in your mind rather than the material influence, you know, into your mind, there is still a material boat anchor thing dragging you down. It's those other persons. You know, maybe you're not so focused on the rocks and trees and stuff anymore, but there's those other individuals, you know, those other persons that are going to drag you away, see, from unity again. And that's why, like, say, for the Hebrews, it took the spiritual influence of supposedly these barbarians, the Babylonians, you know, when the Jews were in exile, it took that for them to finally begin to let go of the people individuating, you know, and disrupting their relationship with unity. So that, because you know, before that, what they called religion was just social justice. Like, see, that's what they're referring to there, that whole bit about the, you know, the social environment. See, that invariably, see, the material gravity drags you down and out to all those other people, and what you call religion just becomes social justice. And that's all the Jews had until they were in exile. And they actually began to discover something genuinely called religion. You know, and getting above social justice.
Through a lot of suffering.
But we're all losing, you know, we're losing that again. Right? Every mainline church is descending back down into social justice. So, you know, they aren't descending, they haven't gone all the way back to, you know, worshiping rocks and trees and stuff, okay? But it's but the unity is being individuated by the associational circumstances of other people.
Humanism.
See, and that reminds you again, genuine religion is something that's apart from everything else. It's just you. Genuine religion is a purely individual phenomenon existing only in your inner life, which has no relationship to things and beings out there. It's just you. Right? And step one is you, the real you, synchronizing with the cosmos, a state called worship.
Oh, that's so selfish.
Right? But it's not long-term selfish. You do this, seek first, not only, the kingdom of heaven. Because first, you need to become a real phenomenon so that there are real fruits of the Spirit coming from you, improving social justice issues. Right? Nothing is going to genuinely progress in that social sphere until the individuals are genuinely religious. Because, see, it's all just ridiculous. Individuals are going to improve the social sphere. No, the individuals are defined by the social sphere. They've uploaded everything. They're not the originator of anything. Right? Until you differentiate from the social environment, become a genuine individual, an originating individual, nothing in that social environment has any way of possibly improving. Right? You have to define it rather than it defining you. As long as you're a helpless victim of the environment, nothing is going to improve. It can't.
You upload and then you go down.
Right. You know, you upload it and, you know, and it's nothing changes except you add delusion to it. Okay, and zealously spit it back out again, thinking that you somehow have grabbed a hold of God or the cosmos or something and are originating some wonderful new thing. No, it's just the environment plus your delusion is what you're spewing out. Okay, it's nothing original.
So that about nails where we're at socially.
That's where we are, yes. It's sad to record that so few persons are genuine originators.
Right. The social justice thing, I realized it's one of the reasons we're in this catastrophe of handing the world to other people. Because we want to be good social justice people.
Right. Yeah.
Is that a weak, caused by a weak 6th and 7th adjutant functioning? Either by choice or because they just don't have it.
Well, the weakness is not.
It seems to drop to the associative level of the 5th.
But remember, it's energized by the 6th. I mean, the 6th is not really the weak point. Right? I mean, it's the 7th.
Right? The unity.
Right? See, because the 7th is what keeps the 6th attached to what's above.
That's when it starts.
That's the weak point.
That's when people think it's selfish.
Right? You know, if the neck of the hourglass is weak, right, then what's below, like the 6th adjutant, doesn't stay, hanging from what's above. You know, it takes on a life of its own. It's not predicated on the cosmos anymore. Evolution and various influences have made the 6th adjutant all the more energetic in every one of us. But the 7th adjutant is still dull in most minds. And so, right, you just have an ever more zealous, self-righteous, lower domain.
Is that what happened to the Native Americans? They said that the red man, that he had, through his tribal warfare continually, the more intelligent strains were killed off. Before the white man ever arrived.
Again, it doesn't matter exactly what happens. Like, you know, like that's a specific example. But zeal, when zeal's the last word, there's only destruction that follows. Whether it's racial destruction because, they kill off one another in warfare or whatever it is, in one way or another, it's self-destructive. When you have this ever more energetic unbridled zeal. Okay. So that's in that third paragraph, that's what's, they're pointing out that relationship between genuine unity and individuality with imaginary unity, there is an illusion. Right? And you have to fight that material gravity trying to drag you out to the things and beings out there, and you might fight it enough to separate yourself from having yourself being drugged and fixated on the things, but good luck with the beings. That's a challenge to let go of all the other beings too and find that personal spiritual experience. Your personality is absolutely unique. You can't share that with any other being. See, it's got to be just you. You got to find you first, then we'll work on the social things. Like Jesus said, seek first.
That's the other thing. It's an imaginary unity worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
It affects everything.
Yeah.
Just imagine that the whole thing is an imaginary thing.
Yeah, and just one little quick thing. That imaginary unity. See, because we're being drugged to the outer life, where there's just individuality, not there's no spirit substance, right, that we're tripping over, bumping our head against out there. So the only way that you can have this imaginary unity out there is uniformity of objects. And so you seek uniformity, poor man's unity, as I call it, right? Right? That's, you know, that's be, you know, between the lines of what we're just reading about here. That desire of spiritually minded or religious people to have some sort of uniformity. Let's all read the same paper of the Urantia book all around the world on the same day. And then we'll have unity. No, you'll have uniformity. See? Whatever it is, it doesn't matter how high-minded the uniformity is, it's still just uniformity. It doesn't matter if it's you're reading the fifth epical revelation, that's still okay. That's not unity. That's uniformity. See, and that's what we're reading about here, that challenge. Can you actually break that bond, that identification first with all that stuff out there and its doings and find the real your real self? Then go back to what's out there and behold, all things will become new if you do it that way. But until you break it, you can't rebuild it.
Quite an economy once that begins to happen, because you're going to recognize what's healthy in that mode. Mm-hmm. Not everything's healthy.
Yeah.
You got to recharge.
See, if you want to really improve the circumstances in the outer world, what you need to be is a real observer. Mm-hmm. See, you have to really get above that. If all you are is, you know, you suck this in and delusionally, you know, create an individuality out of it, there's no real observer of that external world then. You're a drop of water in the ocean. You have to get above the ocean first. Yeah, I got one more thing.
Just what you just said there reminded me of the definition, the etymology of intelligent or intelligence, mm-hmm. intellect, to gather. And that's what you were describing there. You're just gathering. You're just mm-hmm. gathering. See, when it's just in that gathering mode, choice is a whole level. It's something totally different, you know, mm-hmm. or it's a different angle than just gathering. It's like an upward, mm-hmm. you know, grabbing.
Yep. Okay, let's see what else they give us here in this preface.
At one time or another, mortal man has worshipped everything on the face of the earth, including himself. He has also worshipped about everything imaginable in the sky and beneath the surface of the earth. Primitive man feared all manifestations of power. He worshipped every natural phenomenon he could not comprehend. The observation of powerful natural forces such as storms, floods, earthquakes, landslides, volcanoes, fire, heat, and cold greatly impressed the expanding mind of man. The inexplicable things of life are still termed acts of God and mysterious dispensations of providence.
Right, because you believe that those illusions you have about all those things are real. Like if you just set that aside, then poof, all of the, you know, these acts of God and mysterious dispensations of providence disappear. It's like, no, it's just things subject to physical causality and whatnot, okay? Those illusions aren't real that you've attached to all those things. Okay, and again, you just kind of see on steroids, like they're pointing out, since it's going to be fundamentally in this individuality mode, every individuality that you can think of at some point or other, you know, has been an object of worship. Because of that intense individuation of the religious phenomenon, a lot of times you don't even genuinely have reverence. You know, on the second level of meaning, on the unity side, you have reverence. On the individuality side, you have awe. Awe is related to power, you know, individuations of power. See, like they're just going, man feared all manifestations of power. Like that volcano there, right? The volcano isn't ubiquitous, it's there, right? It's not unity, it's individuality. You know, and so a lot of times technically, you know, you're just awestruck, you know, and you're venerating the object of your awe, the volcano. You know, and eventually you personify this, you know, as the volcano god, Yahweh, for instance, you know, or Pele or whatever, right? So, yeah, see, it actually requires a bit of abstraction, a bit of fuzzing out, right? To go from awe to reverence, you have a little bit more sophisticated mind that is kind of just taking that essence of that awe and closing your eyes to the object and then just spreading that essence out, you know, into this unity sea that you feel you're bathed in, and you have that reverence for that unity sea, you know, that sort of essence of that individual awe. You know, and like John mentioned, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, these days that go, you know, get to that, and that's where they fixate. You know, they want to just bliss out in that unity sea that the sixth adjutant feeds them. Right? And they're totally satisfied, so they never go up. Right? They stay there in the bath of reverence. Like the book says, the reverence of unity is not the worship of God. Okay.
All of the Brahmins. You know,
yeah.
Greeks.
No matter who it is, you know, whatever mystical-minded person, you know, you want to talk about. Okay, see anything else there? Just to how that paragraph, obviously is setting up. Now we're going to talk about those. We're going to go in evolutionary order. All these things that mankind has worshipped, let's consider them. One rung of the ladder at a time. What objects are first?
One, worship of stones and hills. The first object to be worshipped by evolving man was a stone. Today, the Kateri people of southern India still worship a stone, as do numerous tribes in northern India. Jacob slept on a stone because he venerated it. He even anointed it. Rachel concealed a number of sacred stones in her tent.
Okay, so three little just quick examples again. We're starting with stones. We'll build up to hills. That example from southern India there, the way that the whole story associated with that, a guy found a stone that said, oh, that's kind of shaped like an ox. And everything went from there. they're still at it. This, you know, sort of quasi-ox-shaped stone, is this object of worship. As I'll mention here in the next paragraph about how these stones were intriguing if they had something special, like, gee, that kind of reminds me of an ox. And then, you know, reminding you of those stories in the Bible, in the Old Testament, notice that they're when you read about Jacob's ladder, you know, the dream there, and he's slept on a stone. Your thought is, he sleeps on this stone. It's very matter of fact. He has this incredible dream vision, quote unquote, and they, this must be a magical stone. Let me anoint it. It's like, see, the revelator is saying, no, the stone is actually antecedent, right? You don't want to forget that there's an initial sense that the stone is sacred. And that's why he's sleeping on it. Well, it's like, if he actually thinks the stone is sacred and he's sleeping on it, that probably generated the dream. Right? You're thinking, I want to learn this book, so if I sleep on it, the way we think about these things, right? Yeah. That belief that there was that he was putting his head closer to the spirit within the stone probably produced the whole imagining. Yeah. They're flipping. And notice there, see, they're saying he venerated it. See, to be technical about it, right? Instead of just saying worship. The sacred stones of Rachel's dad that she, makes off with. that whole story. I mean, they're just reminding you that, you know, you might call them idols, you know, and I'm sort of an immature interpretation of that story. They're saying, no, don't think of it in those kind of more sophisticated terms. Think of it in more basic terms. It's a sacred stone. It's not really an idol. It's just a sacred stone, collection of sacred stones. As recently as back in Jacob's day, you know, you had significant belief in sacred stones still. Like I pointed out, you know, until they got some of that influence from the Babylonians during the 6th century BC, the Jews were still dragging along a lot of evolutionary religion baggage, you know. And that influence finally allowed them to liberate themselves, at least for a while, from all of that stuff. Trees, sacred trees and sacred stones and whatnot, you know, and actually turn their eyes upward to the real God, you know, and 2nd Isaiah gave a lot of voice to that real God.
Moses, as I remember, he had to be pretty harsh with these slow-minded people.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even killing them.
Yeah, I mean, not just Moses, but, you know, all of the reformers, I mean, that's what they did. They just killed everyone that wouldn't let go of the old ways.
Yeah.
And that's how they reformed the people.
It's interesting, though. The Orientalism seems to be giving us, it's almost a transcendence of how things have been done in the past. Another way, not another way, but it's just a flavor of how to approach people with primitive beliefs, you know? It's just like you can respect their beliefs by bringing this in. And it shows respect, but then at the same time you can add, well, you know, and then this is what we... Yeah.
Right, not only can you respect others that are, you know, still functioning in a more primitive mode, but you can, like I said, I mean, the first thing you should do is not look to someone else. It's to look to yourself, you know, and think about, I remember when I was a little kid, I'd pick up a fancy rock as we were walking along, and I'd say, Dad, what kind of a rock is this? Oh, I was in that same mode. You know, I saved a fancy rock. Like, look at that. I found this one. It's got this really cool shape to it. I'm going to keep it, you know, or... You know, let's start a whole pet rock fad. All of that is this. Pet rock fad wasn't a million years ago. Okay? That's that energy. We all start there. Okay?
Stone first impressed early man as being out of the ordinary because of the manner in which they would so suddenly appear on the surface of a cultivated field or pasture. Men failed to take into account either erosion or the results of the overturning of soil. Stones also greatly impressed early peoples because of their frequent resemblance to animals. The attention of civilized man is arrested by numerous stone formations in the mountains, which so much resemble the faces of animals and even men. But the most profound influence was exerted that by the meteoric stones which primitive humans beheld hurtling through the atmosphere in flaming grandeur. The shooting star was awesome to early man, and he easily believed that such blazing streaks marked the passage of a spirit on its way to earth. No wonder men were led to worship such phenomena, especially when they subsequently discovered the meteors, and this led to great reverence for all other stones. In Bengal, many worship a meteor which fell to earth in A.D. 1880.
Yeah, they built a temple over the impact site, you know, and they were off to the races. Okay, and you can go visit it if you want. They threw in reverence there. Like I said, that was... So we have both veneration and reverence now. these, you know, so, I mean, instead of the stone thing dying out, when eventually you got a little bit fancier about this and you were actually starting to look more up towards the profound, you know, to the heavens, and you see these things coming down, you know, that just made the whole stone thing all the more immutable. You know, and so let's pause there for a second. You know, what is this deal about, like I said at the beginning, why is it so difficult to change this stuff? As a matter of fact, it seems like the farther you go along, the more it gets reinforced and becomes just totally impossible to change. Okay? You know, it's because, again, what is this vague shadow notion you've got being, you know, cast down from above? Existential. Right? Yeah, that divine secret, you know, concept has tied with it the existential, the changeless, the eternal. Right? That's why these religious notions are so impossible to change. Because you so existentialize them.
Yeah. You know, in Israel,
yeah,
the temple of the Dome of the Rock, you notice it too, right?
Yeah.
This funny looking thing. And yet, this is what they're fighting over?
All right, the Dome of the Rock.
Yeah.
I see, the sacred rock.
And you think, you know, you mentioned very early when we first started about why, you know, the same things have gone on for a million years. I think fear has a lot to do with it. You know, the fear, whether it's the fear of God, mm-hmm. which Jesus came to try to dispel, but still is pretty much around. You know, the fear of not surviving death, you know, and so therefore, I think there's an awful lot that has to do with that. And I don't know whether it's ingrained fear or whether it's just made up fear or whatever, but that whole change you were talking about from being able to evolve into the love of God
mm-hmm.
is something that seems hard for people to really do.
Yeah.
They can intellectually talk about it, but to really do it is just something that's just tricky for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I've pointed out, you know, Jesus said, I'm going to minister to you. Okay, but if you're going to get what I'm talking about, step one is fear not. See, and that is too high a bar
yeah.
for almost every person.
Because it's their only sense of unity.
Right? Yeah. And so we wonder why no one has really gotten what Jesus was, you know, presenting. And until you can set aside your fear, you can't get to love.
The
best you can get is, you know, like it's there on the level of the feelings. You won't have just raw animal fear. You'll have this reworked fear, fear anew, reverence. Okay, and you know, the love of God will just be downstepped into this veneration notion there on the second level of meaning as well. And that's all you're going to have.
And you still have it for your own father sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, or you know, mother, or whatever. I mean, there's a mm-hmm. fear thing aspect of it.
Yeah.
That I don't know. It just doesn't seem to. We don't seem to have grown out of it.
And see, in many ways, in this life, perforce you serve two masters. Don't beat yourself up too much. I mean, technically, you can't achieve this in any kind of natural developmental way until you're the kind of being that's on the third mansion world. Until you've actually gotten above, you've grown up above all of that animal origin stuff, which just inescapably that the defects of that form generate fear, you know, or the fear-like phenomena in your mind, disruptive, debasing phenomena in your mind. You don't have to wait for sort of the platform you stand on to finally get above all that. You can choose to just stand on higher ground. You know, like Jesus said, don't build on the quicksand, build on the rock. Right? You know, and how do I talk about that? Don't stand, right, you know, on the where your feet are initially planted, choose to rotate 180 degrees. Don't stand on time. Stand on eternity. Right? Another way of saying that same thing that Jesus was saying. Different analogy. Until you do that, you will always, inescapably, be ruled by fear. You're standing on it. How could you not be ruled by it? The only way is to not be standing on it. Like I said, now, as you develop up through the mansion worlds, eventually, what you're standing on, bottom up, is above that. Okay? But there's another solution that you can just choose right now. Rotate 180 degrees and stand on the cosmos instead of on your animal origin foundation. Okay? Your head and fingers are going to still have to deal with the fear stuff. Okay? But your feet won't. Your feet will stand unmoved all the time, like the changelessness of eternity.
Pretty handy if you're going to work in time with your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. You can do much more refined, delicate things if your feet aren't, jiggling.
But you have to stay conscious. It has to go back the other way.
Right. Initially, it has to be a constant, conscious reinforcement. But eventually, your mind becomes habitualized to that, and you just stand there. You don't have to constantly reinforce it consciously. Let's see. So what else do we have there? I think there were some other things. Let's see. Get back to the stuff at hand here. You saw the resemblance to animals. See, like I told you, they were going to mention that. Notice again when they said up front, having is apart from spiritual influence. Okay, so you don't have any consciousness of from the three cosmic intuitions, the three insights, including the first. No, recognition of fact, in play. No recognition of causality. No basic common sense. So that literally, right, you can overturn the soil tilling it, and you can't causally follow that. That the rock was, and you turned the soil over, and now the rock's on the top. For you, it's just magical. All of this, magically, there's this rock on top of the soil. Right?
Stop everything.
And it's like, no, that's impossible. No one could believe that. No, remember when you were little, you thought the universe disappeared. When you went like that.
Yeah.
For peekaboo was a magical thing. Yeah. Right? Right? When you covered your eyes, the universe disappeared. And then you open it and magically it's back again. Because you don't have causal consciousness when you're that little yet. That doesn't come until roughly age 6 when you're encircled in the Holy Spirit. Right? That's the way they all were. Erosion is like, that's a subtler causality thing, but oh my goodness, you overturned the soil and you can't put two and two together. you think the rock magically appeared on the surface?
Is the field ready to plant then? No, forget that.
This rock magically appeared. It's obviously a deity.
We don't
have
to worry about
anything. It was really difficult to get anywhere when you were living in glaciated areas and every shovel full, had a stone in it. Right. glacial debris is just nothing but stones.
Nothing
but you get the point here. Let's see. We all know how much we're fascinated by, that outcrop looks like a man, that sort of stuff. And, and then the whole meteorite thing, you got the Kaaba stone and on, sacred meteors.
Love meteors, though.
And see, they're really cool. See, because we're so material, you can't help but feel positively relative to cool rocks. It's impossible not to. So that's why we're reading what we're reading. Yeah, that's the way you start. You're going to love meteorites.
Yeah.
Right, you'll use the word love. You will venerate them, even if you don't literally start build temples and set up rituals. This little internal thing will still be happening. Oh, this is so cool. I got to put it on my mantle, you know, and I a little sacred place for it, you know, or whatever.
Right? How many people still make a wish?
You know, and you're validated that it's not just you that thinks are cool, because you can sell it for a fortune. So obviously it's real, you know, because otherwise, you know, it wouldn't be so expensive. You know, this is how we think. How do you make jewelry out of it? And yeah, we'll get to that here in a second. Yeah, keep going.
All ancient clans and tribes had their sacred stones. And most modern peoples manifest a degree of veneration for certain types of stones, their jewels. A group of five stones was reverenced in India. In Greece, it was a cluster of 30. Among the red men, it was usually a circle of stones. The Romans always threw a stone into the air when invoking Jupiter. In India, even to this day, a stone can be used as a witness. In some regions, a stone may be employed as a talisman of the law, and by its prestige, an offender can be hailed into court. But simple mortals do not always identify deity with an object of reverent ceremony. Such fetishes are many times mere symbols of the real object of worship.
Okay, so they're pointing out, even in relatively simple individuals, they might have enough sophistication of mind. You know, it might appear that they're venerating the literal stone, but they aren't. You know, they're venerating the spirit or whatever, the god or the deity or whatever they think it is in the stone. And so, again, don't assume the most primitive first. Maybe there's some sophistication as an individual, that seems to be, literally fixated on some magic stone. It's like, well, maybe not. Maybe it's literally a fetish in their mind, and so it's not the stone itself, or it's not the tree itself, it's the spirit in the tree. And you notice that they even put in always identify capital D deity there? See, when you start out in this, it's not a personal mode yet. It's just this mind mode. To be technical about it, what you are vaguely getting a notion of, the shadow that you're playing with is not the shadow cast down by the fact of God, but by the fact of deity. Fundamental quality of deity is unity. Okay, it's not the oneness of God, that you're playing with. It's the unity of deity that you're playing with. So that's why they did that there. So everyone had sacred stones. And see, this very next sentence there, they're jewels. Like they say there, that's where why is it that we venerate, diamonds and rubies and, why are we so raccoon-like? Okay, it's because we've got this amping up of that. It's even though if we don't think about it, it is more than a shiny object to us. It's just a shiny object to a raccoon, but to us, there's this quasi sacredness to it. I mean, we take it really seriously. Any size shiny stone is very expensive, right? Right, because of our veneration for stones. And then, those different groups bringing in different geometries and different numbers and, 30, it's got to be 30, or it's got to be 5, or whatever. And then, you've probably even kind of heard something. With this stone as my witness, You know, I am telling the truth, you know, or whatever. I mean, people will still occasionally say that. You know, they don't literally believe, but see, but there are those that still literally, you know, no, the spirit of that stone, you know, and you take that seriously, you're not going to lie in front of the spirit of that stone. Who knows, you know, what the machinations of the spirit world might do to you. You know, all the way to, you know, I've got this sacred stone, right? Okay, there's nothing I can do, no matter how crude and primitive I am, right? You can, that's my nose ring. You can drag me into court because there's no way. That's so taboo, the thought of not respecting that, the spirit of that stone. You know, even though I'm 10 times bigger than you, I could kill you in an instant. There's no one around. I could easily escape. No, you're trapped. Show you the stone, and the guy can drag you into court. See, again, remember, when the taboos were very powerful like that, you didn't need law enforcement. Right? Okay.
Is that where the phrase getting stoned comes
from? You're waiting for the stone. Yeah, you notice we'll get to that here, you know, eventually. Well, actually, in the next section, that whole bit about, you know, having an altered state of mind and its relationship to the spiritual, you know, and yeah, you can see it.
When Jesus said, when he was coming in on Palm Sunday, mm-hmm. and he said, "Well, if I stop them, these stones will cry out."
Yeah, that's right. Even the stones will begin to sing. Yes, yeah. Right. That's all. See, and he's like we were reading. I mean, that was still very much a part of the common belief system. Right?
In his time.
Yeah, even in his time. Yeah, you know, I mean, because these things it doesn't matter how many. You know, people, some Jewish leader, you know, some Jewish king or whatever, killed, you know, at some point, trying to expunge some of these notions, you know, they come right back. If for no other reason, one of the things we'll see as we go forward here in the evolution of religion, there's always been a belief that the older the notion, the more powerful it is. Okay? So when push comes to shove, you're going to go back to the foundation. You're going to go back to the stone.
Ancient scrolls.
Okay. Whatever it is. Okay.
The ancients had a peculiar regard for holes in stones. Such porous rocks were supposed to be unusually efficacious in curing diseases. Ears were not perforated to carry stones, but the stones were put in to keep the ear holes open. Even in modern times, superstitious persons make holes in coins. In Africa, the natives make much ado over their fetish stones. In fact, among all backward tribes and peoples, stones are still held in superstitious veneration. Stone worship is even now widespread over the world. The tombstone is a surviving symbol of images and idols which were carved in stones in connection with beliefs in ghosts and the spirits of departed fellow beings.
I see. So even when, you know, there's a lot of evolution, I mean, the fancy object is still in play. You know, you have a whole different rationalization scheme attached to it. But again, you basically can't get rid of some of these things when they get started in this religious mode. Because unconsciously, for everyone, they're just existential. You know, and you won't just totally give them up. You will rework the rationalization scheme in some way or another so that, you know, the fancy stone is still there.
Where is stone worship all over the world?
Crystals from the New Age.
Yeah, right. Right, that's a simple one that, you know, we...
Those stones, I guess you're right.
But, you know, you go anywhere in the world where there's, you know, more sort of an evolutionary mode of thinking, and, you know, look around. There's going to be some sacred stone. I mean, you're going to crown your king on a sacred stone, and even if you stop doing that, the stone is still there. It's still venerated, right? You know, it's under the throne or whatever, right? it doesn't have to be totally overt, it's literally overt in a lot of places. I mean, like they mentioned Bengal, okay, there's a temple, okay? You're literally, or go to Mecca, right?
That's true.
Right? The Kaaba stone. Or there's that sacred stone that Muhammad was standing on. There it is. The big fancy dome over it. Whatever. You may not be literally in there. Remember they pointed out that no one may be literally worshiping the stone, but they're worshiping relative to it. They're worshiping, maybe they're not even anymore worshiping the spirit that's in it, but they're worshiping, what it's a symbol of. Right? They can't just worship that fact directly. They've got to be at the stone when they worship that fact.
Kind of like the harem of the fire worshiper that Jesus, Simon couldn't convert, and he was worshiping, it's a symbol.
Yeah, and again, see, because, like they said in the very first paragraph, because it all is really predicated on the illusions. And that's why symbols are so powerful. See, because, it's that's not just a picture. No, there's all kinds of divine secretness attached to that icon. It's all, because it's all really based on illusion, not reality. The quest is for the sacred illusion. You're trying to find the illusion we call God. Everyone is in earnest quest for the illusion we call God. No one is in earnest quest for the real God. Not to go way off the field, but, I bring it up frequently. And they give you the real God here, present the real God, and they tell you, that God that you have long desired a relationship with, do you know that he has no personal presence here? No, I'm not interested in that. I like my illusion God who's personally present here. I have no interest in the real God that doesn't have a personal presence here. So much so that I reject your interpretation of the book. It's not an interpretation of the book. It just tells you that in black and white.
Okay. But he's personal to the Creator, son, though.
Right. There's these downstepped expressions and stuff, right?
So that's a big deal.
But again, it's just a simple logical fact. If he was personally present here, I couldn't be personally present here. Okay? There's no room inside of him for me. He's like really absolutely takes a hold of a space with his personality. There's not going to be any place for you there. We don't really personally take a hold of our mind very well. There's place for all kinds of garbage in there. But he's not like that. Where his personality is, that's an infinite absolute grip. Mine. Okay? There's no you there possible. He can't be personally present here. Right? Not only could I not be here, but nothing else could be here. That table couldn't be here if he was personally present here. You would have to somehow, the table would have to be able to push God aside. No, the table loses. Right? He takes that space. Again, that's, we love these illusions, for various reasons. Revelation doesn't, isn't concerned with affirming your illusions about God.
Chris.
Yep.
Absolute, does that mean not soluble?
Well, I mean literally, but it means, it just means that there's no relativity. I mean, he can't, if he's present, he's absolutely present. He's not present relative to that table relative to me. No, he's absolutely present, period. He can't be anything else. So there can't be anything else there. All right. Just the other little thing in that paragraph. Everyone has probably seen coins with holes in them. They were very common back in the day, especially among certain peoples on the planet. See, and again, what's the deal with holes? Again, remember what the whole quest is here, this divine secret. So, it just adds to it. If you have a totally solid coin, you have to really, really imagine that there's something else there that you can't see. But if you put a hole there, it's right there. It just appears to be a hole, but really it's filled with the divine secret, right? And the porous rock, you can see where the divine secret resides. It's in all those pores.
See? Black hole be the ultimate hole.
Yes. Right, and then exactly. And so you go, wait a minute. What about black holes? Yeah, okay, that's that exact same, baloney, right, as we're talking about here. Right, it's the secret of the universe. Right, and the infinite mystery is buried in that infinite hole.
It's a cool concept.
Yeah, it's a cool concept. But just recognizing that one of the reasons it's cool is something that the scientists don't appreciate in themselves. It's the whole thing. Okay.
Stick with donuts.
The mystery in
there. Yes. Mysterious. Okay, keep going.
Hill worship followed stone worship, and the first hills to be venerated were large stone formations. It presently became the custom to believe that the gods inhabited the mountains, so that high elevations of land were worshipped for this additional reason. As time passed, certain mountains were associated with certain gods, and therefore became holy. The ignorant and superstitious Aborigines believed that caves led to the underworld, with its evil spirits and demons, in contrast with the mountains, which were identified with the later evolving concepts of good spirits and deities.
It all seems kind of silly, but just pause for a minute. See, we've taken a big step forward here when you went into this mode, as they're trying to emphasize there. You no longer have this just horizontal worldview, the stones in the plane, and you venerate them. Look at how you're getting a vertical notion coming into play, and good is up and bad is down. It's like, well, not really, but see, it's vertical. You're adding a vertical notion. See, so these people are starting to bring in a little bit of a higher consciousness. They're starting to recognize that there's levels in their mind.
Heaven and hell.
And they're projecting that recognition of the levels that they are discovering inside. They're projecting that out in the external world and thinking there's levels out there. Okay. That's the point of that. It's a step forward from the beginning of a hierarchy concept instead of the anarchy of just pure stone worship, because everything is a plane. Okay, let's go to the a little bit fancier objects now.
2, worship of plants and trees. Plants were first feared and then worshipped because of the intoxicating liquors which were derived therefrom. Primitive man believed that intoxication rendered one divine. There was supposed to be something unusual and sacred about such an experience. Even in modern times, alcohol is known as spirits.
Right. Oh, yeah. They're pointing out how far back you really established what's almost impossible to break people of, the belief that spiritual is some sort of fancy mind. See, here's how it gets started. You first discover mind-altering chemicals, right? And You know, you have this notion that the spiritual is apart from the commonplace. It's like, well, that person is behaving apart from the commonplace, therefore they're spiritual. Right? And it just goes on from there. And like I said, it gets more and more refined, more and more sophisticated. But still to this day, I mean, almost anyone that uses the word spiritual, you can be guaranteed that what they mean by their use of that word is some fancy mind mode. You know, and maybe it's a pretty straightforward fanciness. Maybe it's just the fanciness of feelings over just the level of the flesh. I'm spiritual because I feel. Right? For them, spiritual is a synonym for feelingful. Just because feelings are fancier than just prosaic, you know, grinding day to day. Yeah, so it doesn't have to be super fancy mind. It can just be, you know, just the most minimalness of fanciness relative to the commonplace. And boom, it's quote unquote spiritual. So, you know, and again, you know, that last sentence, even in modern times, alcohol is known as quote unquote spirits. Like I said, you can't get rid of this stuff, okay? Once it's existentialized by evolutionary religion, I mean, it continues forward. The rock is still there. You're still calling it spirits, even though no one basically, you know, has any notion like that. You know, they've moved on, you know, from just alcohol to strychnine or something. Or whatever. I mean, yeah, it's just that you can't get rid of these notions once they're hatched, because religion falsely existentializes these things.
Well, two things you've mentioned, which are just really, to me, are real problems. One is people don't have a very good knowledge of who God is at all. Mm-hmm. Remember what Jesus said, it's not that God hasn't found you, it's just you just don't know who God is, right?
Yes.
You know, and so that's a... And the whole concept of spirit, you know, as you say, what they mean, because I don't think most people really understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just learning myself. You know, the whole concept of spirit substance. I mean, what?
What? Yes. Right.
What is spirit substance?
I'll never forget
can't you see it over there?
I mean, I'll never forget the day when I first started reading this book, and it finally dawned on me, it's like, wait a minute. I think they're trying to tell me that spirit is a substance. Holy mackerel! He was like, that is so radical. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you know, of course, it's got to be another stuff. You know, and suddenly all of the illusion stuff that I was struggling with just evaporated. It's like, oh, I get it. It's a stuff.
It's a physics.
It has a physics. And
but it has a different...
And if I'm going to relate to it, I have to conform to that physics. You know, if I'm going to, if my arms are going to span the diameter of that table, I actually have to move my hands apart until they're that far apart. No, I can span the diameter of that table when my hands are only 3 inches apart. No, you can't. Well, I believe I can. See, you can have a mystical relationship to the table. In other words, not a real one. Okay? Same way with spirit. It has laws. Right? And you either conform to those laws or you aren't related to it. Any more than my hands are related to the diameter of that table when they're only separated by 3 inches.
So you think of a couple of spirit words, you know, like truth or love or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then you kind of contemplate, now how does that have substance? You know, and that's kind of an interesting thing to contemplate.
Right, the beginnings of that with spirit as a substance... It's like, well, okay, if it's a substance, substances have properties. What's the name, what's the word that refers to the properties of spirit substance? That's what that word value is. Before you go to fancy things like truth and love and whatnot, just start with the basics. Spirit's a substance and it has properties. Those properties are a mysterious thing we call values. Okay, so I can't see spirit substance, so I bet I can't see its properties either. So value is not something I can point to.
I can understand it.
It's something that I can recognize abstractly, you know, et cetera. See, I mean, that's how you begin to have a grounded factual relationship to these thoughts, right? And you know, and if you're going to have a religion of the spirit, so you got to get out of your mind, right? There's no spirit substance in your mind. Okay.
Get out of your mind.
Yeah. Right? Otherwise,
they talk about mind a lot.
Right. Otherwise, you have just a religion of the mind. And the book tells me, I know I've got to try to get beyond a religion of the mind. I have to get to a religion of the spirit. Yeah, see, well, that's not religion of the fancy mind. That's a religion, that's something tied to that other stuff in the external world. Yeah, et cetera. Yep.
Yeah, in a way, our relationship to money is subtly changing because of modern forms. At one time, it was almost universally believed that gold had intrinsic value.
Right.
That there was value, that something about the substance of gold.
Right, it was a fetish, basically. See, you know, there was, yeah, divinity in the gold by nature. Yeah. Yeah, and once it's not so much of a fetish, because science has disabused you of that belief, okay, well, then what? Well, it's still shiny and cool, and the exalted raccoon in you loves it. But it's more difficult to wield man, like that talisman wielded, you know, that guy that needed to be hailed into court. We lose our nose rings, you know, see, you know, and then mankind becomes more and more difficult to control. See, and that's the thing. I mean, obviously, the more that you can't be controlled by the illusions that you attach to external objects, the control has to be chosen within you. The law has to be written in your hearts, in your heart, not embedded in a stone, like they were just saying. And that's the challenge. But the transition period, when you lose the former, you know, the former and haven't gained the latter, that's where we are right now. There's no law at all.
Is spirit substance in life animation?
No, life animation is like personality. It's not a stuff in any way.
But it's a...
But a way you can begin to think about it is, unlike matter, spirit is a stuff that has the life animation already added to it. It's innate, or inherent in it, whereas you have to add life animation to matter to make it living matter. Spirit substance is already living stuff.
Self-animating substance.
It's a self-animating substance. All right, let's keep going here.
Early man looked upon spouting grain with dread and superstitious awe. The Apostle Paul was not the first to draw profound spiritual lessons from and predicate religious beliefs on the sprouting grain.
Right, you look at a seed... Right, and then you look at the plant that sprouts out of it. No, right? It's totally magical. You know, it's this little rock-like thing, and suddenly it's a green plant. That radical transformation of form, you know, like Paul played off of that. It's like, okay, your body here is like the seed. Your body on the first mansion world is like the plant. Right, and the seed has to die. Your body here has to die in order for you to have the next body. You know, he played off of that. And again, it's all because it's just it's so mysterious, especially when you have no causal consciousness, right? It's so mysterious. Well, obviously, I'm seeing the divine secret manifesting right before me, right?
Jesus used that same analogy.
Sure, right. Yeah. Right, so, but see, again, it starts with, so you've got dread there too. That's on the level of the flesh. That's the unity side of the level of the flesh. And you've taken fear up to that first, quote-unquote, spiritualization of it, if you will, to dread. And then you go up to the second level with awe. See, so just like, you know, they're just pointing out the, you know, the details of this. It's superstitious awe, like I was saying, because, you know, it appears that there's something beyond what meets the eye to it. You're going, there's something that stands above it, superstition, right? There's some mysterious divine secret that stands above it, overarching it, right? See, that's the literalness of that superstition, above standing, right? There's something transcendent, right? You know, that you believe, you know, that in that illusion mode about it.
Because the grain is obviously dead.
Yeah.
And then it becomes living.
Living. You know.
Where's the life come
from? Yeah, where does it come from? Yeah. 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 I mean, just how much dread and superstitious awes are going to be there if they're completely sort of stupefied, you know, with transcendent mystery by the stone that suddenly is magically on the surface of the ground when you're turning the soil. Right? How much more amazing is the sprouting grain? Okay.
The cults of tree worship are among the oldest religious groups. All early marriages were held under the trees, and when women desired children, they would sometimes be found out in the forest affectionately embracing a sturdy oak. Many plants and trees were venerated because of their real or fancied medicinal powers. The savage believed that all chemical effects were due to the direct activity of supernatural forces.
You know, and I mean, you were still struggling with a lot of that, you know, in the 19th century, you know, as the Enlightenment was trying to bring some genuineness of science into play. You know, a lot of those early physical discoveries were still kind of in this mode. It's like, ooh, I've discovered some supernatural force. And, you know, I think everyone knows about all the fancy schemes that were dreamt up back there in the 19th century. Until you really started to think about chemistry in a physical fashion rather than the illusory mystical fashion.
And now have cannabis churches.
Right, and then you can bring it all back again by finding a new plant to, you know, to deify.
What were you doing at the bar? That's my church.
Yes. And again, you've got, you know, all the early marriages were held under the trees, and like I was saying, and remember, especially if they have no concept that the sex thing is what, you know, leads to children, and you're trying to figure out exactly how you get children, well, I don't know, go hug a tree. Because there's all kinds of mysterious life in that big tree, you know, I mean, it won't miss a little bit, you know, draw a little bit off and, you know, and get pregnant. All right, yeah, let's keep on.
Ideas about tree spirits varied greatly among different tribes and races. Some trees were indwelt by kindly spirits, others harbored the deceptive and cruel. The Finns believed that most trees were occupied by kind spirits. The Swiss long mistrusted the trees, believing they contained tricky spirits. The inhabitants of India and eastern Russia regarded the tree spirits as being cruel.
Not regarded, regard. One might note there.
The Patagonians still worship trees, as did the early Semites. Long after the Hebrews ceased tree worship, they continued to venerate their various deities in the groves. Except in China, there once existed a universal cult of the Tree of Life.
Yeah, and of course they're pointing out, well, the actual Tree of Life didn't improve this situation with venerating trees. It's like, okay, now it's given. You'll never get rid of it now. Right? Just like the meteor. Okay, you're never going to get rid of the rock thing now. In both cases, it just gets, you get this confirmation that you aren't imagining it's existential. No, it really is. This proves it. Again, you know, it's like big sigh. It's like, okay, this is going to be with us for a long time. And the Hebrews with the, you know, the tree thing, you know, you can try, like, you know, again, you, some king can try killing everyone as far as the eye can see who won't let go of the tree thing. No, you can't get them to let go of it. They're still going to hold on to that belief. You know, it's just very, very difficult, you know, to disabuse people of these notions. Okay.
It's interesting that they say, except in China.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm thinking about their minds, and their minds might be like the elephants, and they just don't let any rogue go off, you know, and fly off. That associative thing is just so strong.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the deal is there, but, you know, with the except in China, but...
And they still do it today.
You'd have to work through that and see if you can figure out if it's... If it's nature or nurture or geography or what, you know. And then as I injected, you know, I hope you didn't mind, you know, the fact that that's present tense, you know, when it says, the inhabitants of India and Eastern Russia regard. Right. The tree spirits as being cruel. And it just, you know, notice how they, you know, they take you all the way down to southern South America, you know, with Patagonia and everything. It's just, you know, it doesn't matter where you go or what, you've got this.
Four corners.
All right.
The belief that water or precious metals beneath the earth's surface can be detected by a wooden divining rod is a relic of the ancient tree cults. The maypole, the Christmas tree, and the superstitious practice of wrapping on wood perpetuate certain of the ancient customs of tree worship and the later day tree cults.
Unless the spirits might think we're too irreverent, I think we better knock on wood.
Yeah,
just, you know, just be on the safe side. what does it hurt to just, you know, make sure we appease the ancient gods as well as we're trying to appease the, you know, the current ones? I mean, and so, you know, it just they're moving towards some of the other things. You know, when we get to the worship of elements and stuff. You know, and they bring up water and metals, and but
even the Christmas tree.
they couldn't even be reverent about the Christmas tree, for Pete's sake. This book is so irreverent. It offended me about my notions of God. It offended me about the Christmas tree. What's next? You know, it's not going to respect your ideas about the atomic nucleus. It's not going to respect you. It doesn't matter what it is, okay? But notice that they're pointing out, it's saying, you know, they bring up water and metals and stuff. And, you know, that's two sections away here directly. But it starts with just the spirit in the wood. You know, see, and again, you know, you may think that, oh, this person believes in magic or something. It's like, no, they believe that there's a spirit in the wood, and do you think you can question what the spirit might know about where water and metals are? I mean, isn't God all-knowing? Don't you believe that? Right. You know, you just, so you know, you're just, again, it's a fetish object.
But what's the atomic nucleus? I don't have an idea about it.
Yeah, well, if you have any idea, you probably think it's a collection of little bigger balls called protons and neutrons.
Is the ion the nucleus?
You know, and the bringing in the maypole, of course, you know, gives us we've had a couple things that kind of harken back to the section about marriage and family, right? I mean, obviously there will be overlap with the sacred concepts relative to sex, you know, that we read about, you know, with some of these other, you know, combine that with you know, the power of wood. You know, and you've got festival on May Day, right? We already saw that, you know, you don't know how to get pregnant, but, well, go try hugging a tree. It's like, well, you could have sex. It's like, what? That doesn't have anything to do with pregnancy. right? Yeah. But once you figure out, that sex actually does produce a child, you still have the tree basically there. You know, for fecundity reasons and whatnot, with the maypole. So these things, like I said, these things, they just, you can't get rid of them. They go forward in some form, inescapably. Okay, one last little thing here, we'll wrap it up.
Many of these earliest forms of nature veneration became blended with the later evolving techniques of worship. But the earliest mind agitant activated types of worship were functioning long before the newly awakening religious nature of mankind became fully responsive to the stimulus of spiritual influences.
Okay, so see, that's kind of a nice bookend place to wrap it up. Kind of right back to where we started in the beginning of the preface, that we're talking about worship, quote unquote, but not really. This is. This is mind agitant activated types of worship. So, in other words, it's basically reverence with some veneration thrown in. And, which means that it's, I didn't mention that before. Think about that. The very diffused fact of reverence gets a little bit focused on an individuality when you say veneration, right? I mean, you can't really think of just a completely amorphous sort of veneration. You're venerating that, or right? And you can say the same. I revere that. You can just be in a state of reverence. See, with no object. So it's. the veneration is bringing in a little bit more of that individuality thinking, with this. But all of that can totally happen in the lower domain, the hourglass analogy of your mind or self. All you need is just the adjutants. You don't need any, direct stimulus of spiritual influences. And just the way they said that at the end, stimulus of spiritual, there's these two stuffs in the external world, matter and spirit substance, and it's not immediately apparent, but both of them stimulate your mind. And there is a representation in your mind relative to that external fact. You can be influenced by matter or spirit, even though neither matter nor spirit is in your mind. Right? Through a mystery that we don't need to go into right now, somehow something bridges the gap, right, between that matter and spirit in the external world and produces a representation, of a stimulus relative to them in your mind. You don't need to know how that happens, but it does happen. And see, what you're seeking is a relationship to those spirit substance stimuli, which can't be found except up at the very top In the hourglass analogy, that's the spiritual level, because that's the level that directly interfaces with spirit substance above in the analogy. Just like matter is, you know, is butted right up against the bottom, you know, in the hourglass analogy.
And then spirit gravity, how does that deal with the substance?
Obviously you only experience spirit gravity indirectly to begin with. Your spiritualized mind, it's actually the spirit above that feels the spirit gravity, but that spirit ministry above is engaged to your mind, and so your mind indirectly feels some spirit gravity. But all that becomes literalized when you stick a thought adjuster in the mind. It directly feels spirit gravity, and it's stuck in your mind, imprisoned in your mind. So it drags your mind with it. Okay? You know, I mean, that's kind of the literally how you can understand why you would ascend.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's spirit gravity pulling you up. It's like, well, technically it's grabbing a hold of the thought adjuster and pulling it up back to where it came from. You know, but it's imprisoned in your mind, and so it drags you with it.
Oh, thank goodness.
And that's why you ascend. you know, without it, you can't ascend. Because you don't, you know, like I was just saying, you don't literally yourself feel spirit gravity. You're not a blob of spirit, you know. So, okay, let's see, anything else there? The other thing there, like I was saying with sex, you know, getting blended in with this stuff. You see, like I said, many of these earliest forms of nature veneration became blended with the later evolving techniques of worship. Yeah. You know, again, like I was saying, this stuff doesn't go away. So invariably, it gets blended in, you know, and re-rationalized and carried forward, you know, and the farther you go along, the more things have gotten blended in, and so the more they overlap, and there's crosstalk, and you get these, you know, these rationalizations between stones and plants that, you know, are only there when you have both stones and plants together in your rationalization scheme, and it just gets more and more and more complicated as you go forward, until finally you have a lot of the religions of today, you know, that just, it takes a professional to keep track of all the details, when of course, you know, genuine religion is not complicated. It's very simple. You know, and doesn't require an expert, a priest, you know, to keep track of the details of it for you. As a matter of fact, the priest is a boat anchor. The more you think about the priest, the more your mind is being dragged out and identified with him, and it's not reaching up and identifying with the cosmos. Okay, I think we got everything there. Yeah, so you can tell they just wanted to remind you that we're not going to get to the fancier stuff quite yet. We want to work, they're going to work through some more of these basics. But the more you understand all these basics, the more you can appreciate the complexities of the fancier stuff that we'll talk about eventually. And the more that you can take, you can start going through that complicated thing you have in your head right now that you call religion and dissect it. It's like, oh, that's the stone part, and that's the plant part, and that's the the whatnot. You know, you can start to clear away all of these things. It's like, okay, now what do I have left? Oh, a blank slate. Cool. Now we can start fresh. so that's why they're giving you, you know, this exhaustive description of all these things, so that you can clear your mind of all your notions of God that are just fancified, exalted things predicated on animals and stones and plants and whatnot, and get to the real God. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.